You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jeffrey Deskovic served 16 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit before he was finally exonerated. When he left prison as a free and innocent man, he found that reentering society was full of unexpected challenges and there weren't many places to turn to for help. So he founded an advocacy organization and support group for exonerated former inmates, the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. And he's here with us now, along with Kian Khatibi and William Lopez, who have also been exonerated after serving prison time. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having
Thanks,
us.
Thanks, Leonard.
Thank you.
Jeffrey, over the past few months, I've read a number of newspaper stories about exonerated inmates. Is something going on right now?
Yes. There's been a flood of recognition of the problem of prosecutorial misconduct leading to wrongful convictions. And as a result of that increased awareness, there's more and more exonerations taking place.
Well, a lot of that is taking place in Brooklyn, but none of the three of you are from Brooklyn, are you?
Except William Lopez's case is a Brooklyn case.
Jeff, when did you found your organization?
In September of 2012.
And what kinds of things does your organization do to help exonerated inmates adjust to freedom?
Well, we have a reintegrative program. We have an apartment that's leased, providing short-term housing. We have some emergency funding. We maintain regular contact with the exonerees. We're able to refer them to other advocacy organizations that can help them with employment.
And all of this grew out of your own experiences when you got out of prison.
Yeah. Yes, it did.
What kinds of challenges did you face?
Well, you're released with nothing, so there was financial challenges. I was never able to obtain gainful employment because I didn't have the same level of job experience as other applicants did. I faced a number of psychological aspects from post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety attacks, panic attacks. I had to try to rebuild relations with my immediate and extended family. Technology was different as well.
Well, when people get out of prison after they've served time for crimes they did commit, aren't there services available to them? Is it different if you're exonerated?
It's very different. One of the ironic things is that if you were guilty and on parole, you would have more governmental as well as non-governmental assistance, whereas if you're exonerated, there's no help for you.
And does anybody know why that is?
I think it's largely an overlooked population. Another problem is that we're not all centralized. I mean, it's a lot of exonerees in New York, but we live in different parts and then throughout the country as well.
Now, Kian, what kinds of challenges did you face when you were exonerated?
Well, I mean, the challenges are large. And, well, basically everything I had to learn over again, how to live in society, how to pump gas on a car. I mean, everything had changed so much.
No, that's because you were young. You didn't even have identification, did you?
When I was released, no, it was just kind of like an emergency release order out of Westchester County Court. And they said, here, you're free. You can walk out that door. And all I had was my prison clothes, no ID, no anything.
And then you had to find a place to live?
Well, I had my family, thankfully. Not everybody does upon release after years of being incarcerated. But I slept on a couch and it was better than a prison bed, I'll tell you that.
What had you been in prison for?
I was in prison after being convicted for assault in the first degree and possession of a dangerous instrument.
How did you find out that it was your brother who actually committed the crime?
Well, in 2007, my brother, during a family event right around the time of Thanksgiving, he had confessed to being the person that did it to my father and sisters and brothers.
But he'd let you serve the time for him?
That is correct.
And you'd only found out in 2007?
That's true. In 2007 is when I found out that my brother had committed it. At the time of the assault, he was labeled a suspect. And, you know, you can imagine me being an innocent person going to trial and getting convicted. My mind runs all over the place on who could have done this. All I know, it wasn't me. I did not know it was him. I talked to my father about it. I talked to him about it. And he simply said he was not there. And I didn't know what to believe. All I knew is I did not do it.
How long were you imprisoned?
9.5 years.
And is it after he told your family that you finally were able to prove your innocence and get out?
That is correct.
Are some jurisdictions harder to get a case open than others?
Yes, I think that a lot of the southern states are harder.
Now, Ken, how did you learn about Jeffrey's organization?
Well, when I was released in 2008, I got a computer, and for the first time I had access to this wonderful amount of information. I started looking up wrongful convictions because I wanted to find out if it was a real phenomena or, you know, if I had an isolated experience. And I came across Jeffrey Deskovitz's name and email when he wrote for a newspaper in Westchester County, and it says, please contact me if you have any questions. And I emailed him.
Well, William, you just got out of prison a little over a year ago, right?
Yeah, that's correct, sir.
How long had you spent time in prison?
Well, actually, I spent 23 and a half years, sir.
23 and a half years for a crime you didn't commit.
Wow. Absolutely.
What were you accused of?
I was accused of allegedly killing a drug dealer in a botched robbery in Brooklyn in 1989.
This isn't one of those Scarcella cases, is it?
Oh, actually, it wasn't a Scarcella case, but we are doing some investigating just, you know, in the event that he was involved in something.
How did you work to get yourself exonerated?
Well, actually, I dedicated a lot of years in the law library, and I spent a lot of years trying to figure out a way to get back into court and persuade a judge to reopen the case. Finally, in 2005, I had a federal judge grant me my wish, reopened the case, then assigned me counsel and an investigator to reinvestigate the case.
And I guess in an odd way, you were self-educating while you were in prison. That's the only good thing that probably came out of this experience.
Well, that's actually, I spent a lot of time. I felt that I had to spend a lot of time in a school setting, keeping my mind, to keep my sanity. That I used that to try to maintain sanity and at the same time to try to use, you know, whatever means I had to try to find a way back into the court system.
Ken said that when he came out, he had to learn about all the new technology. Did you have access to computers in prison?
Well, fortunately for me, the law library was one of the areas where there was computers. However, they're very ancient, like 20, 30 years old. But they were still computers, so it allowed me to maintain some type of contact with the computers. I just briefly state, in 2005, after reopening the case, I was able to contact, I seen Jeffrey Deskovitz Foundation open up his doors, and I reached out to him. And he was able to also jump on board with my attorneys to assist in that investigative part.
But it sounds like it's been a long process. You said 2005, and you got out in 2013.
Yes.
It took 7 years?
Yes.
And what happened when you got out? Was it a really strange world?
Oh, absolutely. The world was so, I mean, it was extraordinary. I spent, like I said, I went in 1989 where metro cards were non-existent. The internet was non-existent. We had tokens. The phones were on the corners, every corner, you know, regular phones. Today, I mean, the world is so fast. It's incredible. It's incredible. It's incredibly fast, and it's changed so much.
And you weren't aware of this when you were in prison? I asked you this too, Kian. I mean, didn't you watch television? Did you see some of these changes occurring?
Well, watching television in prison, it's generally just movies and this and that, and we don't necessarily get to pick what's on. It's you don't really get a lot from TV of what's going out in the world. You might catch a news clip here and there, but it's like nothing like you can really imagine having stepped foot outside and seeing what a cell phone actually.
No, it's correct.
And seeing hybrid cars.
Yes, hybrid cars. But as Keon was saying briefly, it's generally the population it controls the television. The majority of the guys want to watch very, you know, I mean, they're all, most of the guys in there are guilty. So they're there to kill their time. I mean, literally kill time.
Mm. My guests are William Lopez and Kian Khatibi, who have recently been released from prison, and Jeffrey Deskovic, who was released how many years ago?
Seven.
And has created the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. Jeffrey, you must understand so well what these people you help are going through, since you went through it yourself. What were you in prison for?
I was in prison for murder and rape, which I was arrested at 16. I was 17 by the time the trial rolled around, and I was convicted despite a negative DNA test. My wrongful conviction was caused by a coerced false confession, prosecutorial misconduct, fraud by the medical examiner, and a public defender.
And where was this?
This was in Westchester County, New York.
Now, doesn't having confessed make it harder to get a case reconsidered?
No, it does, but the fact of the matter is that coerced false confessions are the cause of wrongful convictions in 25% of the DNA-proven wrongful convictions, with particularly vulnerable populations as being identified as youth and people with mental health, and I was 16 years old at the time.
And we had some members of the Central Park Five who were convicted and imprisoned for a crime none of them were involved in. They also made false confessions. And afterward, I received any number of emails from people who said they did it. And they just would not believe that there could be such a thing as a false confession.
Right, but that's where the science of DNA has helped establish that as a scientific truth.
Well, and
that was how I was cleared, actually, Leonard. Is, you know, I got further. I lost all seven of my appeals. I was turned down for parole. And ultimately, I was cleared because further DNA testing obtained by the Innocence Project, it not only reaffirmed my innocence, but it identified the actual perpetrator who subsequently confessed and was arrested and convicted for the crime.
You can only wonder what it was like before DNA evidence was collected. There were probably an awful lot of people who lived their whole lives in prison. There probably still are people living their whole lives in prison for crimes that they didn't commit.
There's no question about that, because not only was the science not around, but you have to think, even with it around, DNA is only available in 5 to 12% of all serious felony cases, you know, which is why you know, we mentioned the reintegrative aspect of my foundation. We raise awareness. We seek legislation to prevent these type of injustices from happening. But then we try to exonerate people also, not just in DNA cases, which is what most of the organizations in the field limit themselves to, but also in the non-DNA cases, because most of these people in prison, DNA is not an option for them. And I personally felt that it was unacceptable that somebody would be in prison, have a way of proving it, but stays in because they don't have anybody to do the boots on the ground type work, which is, you know, and I'm really overjoyed. I'm really humbled just, you know, to, for my foundation to have, you know, played a role in helping William to get his freedom.
Now, what was it like to go into prison as a teenager and come out 16 years later as an adult? Kian has talked about how that worked for him. Was it similar for you?
It did. I tried to take advantage of the time that I was there. I got a GED, an associate's in liberal arts. I completed a year of schooling, further schooling. I read a lot of books. But, you know, that was just trying to do something with my time. But, I mean, the reality besides that and at the same time is that to be incarcerated for something you didn't do, that's a living hell. It's a nonstop obstacle course featuring the other prisoners, the guards, and the civilians, all as obstacles to the ultimate goal, which is to regain your freedom and to prove you're innocent. You know, I have to say that you have to fight. You're not just fighting an external battle, trying to stay away from the obstacles. You're trying to prove your case in court against often a doubting judiciary. But then also it's an inner struggle. You have to fight off feelings of helplessness, hopelessness, depression, thoughts of suicide come in your mind.
And you're also in prison with a lot of really bad people. And we'll take a little break and we'll come back to that and other issues. And what life has been like since you got out. Some people feel that they will never be able to be the person they could have been. My guests are Jeffrey Deskovic, who has created an organization called the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice to help people who have been exonerated return to normal life. And he has brought along Kian Khatibi and William Lopez, two people who have been exonerated for crimes that they didn't commit. Stay with us for more. We are back with Jeffrey Deskovich, who has started an organization that is an advocacy group and support group for exonerated former inmates. It's called the Jeffrey Deskovich Foundation for Justice. And he has brought along with him Kian Khatibi and William Lopez, who have also been exonerated after having served prison time. Now, one of the things you're fighting for, Jeffrey, is the whole matter of false confessions and
and
having people re-examine that whole process?
Yes. One of the things I'm fighting for is for there to be legislative changes to prevent wrongful convictions from happening. The causes are known. We need better identification procedures. We need legislation to videotape interrogations. We need to criminalize concrete clear-cut intentional prosecutorial misconduct. We need to have a centralized evidence preservation system so that if someone is lucky enough that there is DNA available in their case, that it can be it's not lost. It can be preserved, and we could do the testing. So, I mean, the causes of wrongful conviction are known. If people would like to learn more about it, they can go to www.deskovich.org.
Now, William, you were also misidentified.
That's correct, sir.
What happened?
Well, there was actually two eyewitnesses that were initially used. One of the witnesses, however, could not identify me at court and absolutely absolved me from the crime. The other witness was a crack user, which was given a deal in exchange for her testimony in which she stated that she witnessed after a couple of days of smoking crack and being up for protracted time, she allegedly witnessed me commit this crime. However, like I said, she was given a deal in exchange for this testimony.
And often, as we have heard in when there are a number of cases like this, the same crack addict or pimp or whatever is used again and again as a witness, always seem to be conveniently on the scene of the crime. But after the fact, are the police and prosecutors involved in cases like this held accountable for what they have done?
Leonard, there's a horrible doctrine called prosecutorial immunity, in which you can't – anything that the prosecutors do, no matter how egregious, if it happens after arrest, you cannot sue them. They don't face criminal penalties. Really, the cops don't face criminal penalties either. The only difference between the two entities is you could bring lawsuit against law enforcement, whereas you cannot against the prosecutor.
And a couple of prosecutors have lost their jobs. There have been people who have worked in labs, police labs, who have really messed up, and people have also gone to jail as a result of that. But what about public defenders? Did you have, Kian, did you have a public defender or did you have a paid lawyer?
At the time of my trial, I had a retained lawyer who was paid for.
Did he do a good job, do you think?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. There's always more in these cases that an attorney can do. Ultimately, it's usually the fault of police investigation or overzealous prosecutor. But, you know, I think if he did do a good job, I probably would not be sitting here today.
Were you also misidentified?
I was misidentified, yes. The victims had signed statements stating that they positively identified me as the person that stabbed them, which was flatly not true.
But, of course, that always will be convincing to a jury.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the jury
I saw
was
this guy over here. I point to him, and he's the one who was there. He's the one who did the stabbing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The same for you, William?
yes, Leonard.
Did you have a public defender?
I had a public defender, an 18B attorney, which is assigned counsel, which did not do a very good job at all.
Well, they're often overworked. They try to do the best job they can.
Well, that's correct. That's correct, sir. Not to take much away from them. They are overworked. Their caseloads are very large, and they are expected to, to handle those very large caseloads, which it's impossible to do all the necessary work that's actually necessary for a good defense.
And what about you, Jeffrey?
I had a public defender, and being as I was so young at the time, I was 17, I didn't really know to question him. I had a public defender. He did a horrible job. He never presented my alibi witness. He didn't cross-examine the medical examiner, whose fraud was the key to the prosecution challenging the DNA exclusion. He shouldn't have represented me because of a conflict of interest. I mean, that added to the police and prosecutorial misconduct.
Now, you all connected through Jeffrey. Has it been helpful to meet other exonerated people who've had an experience like yours?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's great to go and meet somebody and talk to them and see how they adjust. It lets you know you're not alone, and what avenues can you pursue to get yourself back on your feet.
Same. But William, I'm sure that there were people in prison who were also telling you that they were innocent. What did you think? Did you believe them all?
Well, actually, sir, you're absolutely right. They're working in a law library setting. I had a lot of individuals come to me and actually look for help, look for assistance, since they knew that I was pursuing my case.
You are a de facto public defender here.
Exactly. I did it for 23 years. Sometimes it's a little difficult to try to weed the actual from the non-actuals. There are a lot of guys. Everyone in prison seems to be innocent. No one likes to take, responsibility. However, I did have a lot of guys that come, and I was able to weed out the ones that were. There are quite a few, unfortunately.
Who really shouldn't have been in prison.
That should, till this moment, till this actual day, should not be.
And do you have a feeling now that you might very well be able to take the test and become a lawyer?
Well, I'm actually, you hit it right on the button. I'm actually considering pursuing a legal career, going to law school. I'm actually looking right now for a good paralegal position. I do happen to like the legal field very much.
Ken, what are some of the things that Jeffrey's organization has helped you with?
Well, let me tell you, when he first started, we kind of helped each other. I went over there. I was in my first year of law school.
So all of you wind up either being affected in that way. Jeffrey creates this organization, which has a legal aspect to it, and the two of you are going to law school, or thinking anyway?
Well, I graduated in May from Benjamin N. Cardozo Law School in Greenwich Village. During my first year, I interned over at the foundation when it first opened up, and that was a wonderful experience getting to read the letters from the inmates and working on behalf of them.
And I assume you're going to try to specialize in this kind of law?
In the coming months, I'll be searching for a job in criminal defense or civil rights litigation, hopefully here in New York City.
Offering legal services to other exonerated former inmates?
Well, I would love to reach out to inmates who are still incarcerated and be that person they can go to and write to and say, help me, I'm innocent.
Great.
Well, the real issue, seems to me, is all of you served really long sentences despite the fact that you were not guilty, and you all started working to prove your innocence, it seems to me, from the day you wound up in prison on. So this is a very long process, isn't it, Jeffrey?
It is. The average length of wrongful incarceration is 13 and a half years. Wrongful convictions are not an aberration. They happen much more frequently than what we in society realize. It's been 313 DNA proven wrongful convictions, close to 2,000 when you factor in non-DNA exonerations. In terms of me, Leonard, I graduated in May. I have a master's degree in criminal justice from John Jay. And in terms of my future aspirations, I've applied to the doctoral program at the CUNY Grad Center. I hope to get some laws passed to prevent this from happening, reforms like we've already talked about. And the other thing is, you know, I need to make my foundation sustainable. I might have started it, but there's a lot more wrongfully convicted people, such as Keon and other people, other Keons, other mm-hmm. Bill Lopez's that are out there. And I hope that we can remain around not only to serve them, but that to be a life legacy. I want my suffering to mean something.
My guests are Jeffrey Deskovic, Keon Katibi, and William Lopez, all exonerated after serving long prison terms. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the Innocence Project is responsible for getting many wrongfully convicted people exonerated, but it doesn't have the resources for a program to help the exonerated. Where you come in?
That's where I come in. But the other major aspect of where I come in is they will only take on a case if it has DNA. They will not take on a non-DNA case.
What rights do exonerated inmates have for compensation for having been wrongfully imprisoned, especially when there was police or prosecutorial malfeasance?
In New York State, we're fortunate because you can seek compensation through the statute, the Unjust Convictions Act, and then also you're able to, if the facts of your case fit it, you can file suit in federal courts, filing a federal civil rights lawsuit.
So that's what funded your foundation in the first place?
Yes. I decided when I found myself in possession of some compensation, I decided to draft myself. I mean, you know, I was critical that most organizations would not do non-DNA cases, so why not step forward? And then I would just hope that people would join me after that. Again, if people would like to go to the website, it's www.deskovic.org.
Now, Keon, I mentioned earlier that you were in prison with some pretty rough people. You were just a kid. How did you survive?
How did I survive? Well, at first I was thinking the same question myself, and then you either fail or you sail, and you learn right away, you know, I've got to, well, maybe pretend to be somebody I'm not, you know.
Be tougher than you thought yourself as being.
Don't walk around telling people, oh, hi, I'm innocent. I haven't been in a fight before. You better play the image right away, especially when you're going in young and you're not used to the criminal lifestyle.
And William, you're nodding your head.
Yes, no, because I'm reflecting exactly what Mr. Keon's saying there. He's so true, so right. You have to go in there and be someone that you're really not in order to survive. Otherwise, you become a target.
When I look back at it, you know, it's a miracle I made it through, because as you mentioned earlier, Leonard, I was sent to a men's maximum security prison, and I was
17 years old,
weighing 150 pounds. I mean, you know, even though people ask me how I survived, yet despite having that answer, I still sit back and marvel about that too. I don't understand fully.
How do you deal with the anger you must all feel that this injustice was done to you? You lost a large part of your lives.
Yeah, me in particular, sir. I try to just use. I don't think about it much. I try to look at it as a, you know, something that happened. Of course, I just try to. I don't try to make it seem as though, you know, I don't want to hold on to the bitterness and to the angerness. Although I am, and despite I do possess, you know, a lot of it, I just try to make the best of it, and I try to use the integration with Jeffrey, Keon, and all the with the foundation to try to make myself, you know, to try to purge and feel, you know, get that.
Well, but Keon, you must have been depressed for a while, or maybe still are sometimes.
Yeah, well, without a doubt, I think everyone comes out with a bit of, you know, it's kind of like bittersweet. You're happy that you're out, but you can't get your time back. But, Leonard, the way I look at it is that, you know, the people that were responsible for my incarceration, they had taken enough from me already. 9.5 years of my life, and I'm not going to let them take another day of my happiness away.
I would like to add, I have the same rationale as Keon. The thing I would like to add is the vehicle which enables me to actualize that as I take the energy that I would otherwise feel and I channel it into the advocacy work that I do. So there's that part of it. And in some ways, the work is cathartic. And lastly, I feel like I went through what happened to me because this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I feel like I've had my purpose in life.
Well, in the few moments that we have left, I wonder whether you have all the rights that you would have had if you hadn't been in prison. How do you explain when you look for a job that there are these missing years? Can you vote? Is your criminal record expunged?
I can vote. I have voted every year since I've been out, and my record is expunged.
The same for you, Keon?
Well, to a certain degree. Certain licenses and this and that, when you're applying in New York State, you have to disclose a felony conviction. I think the law is kind of ambiguous whether you've been exonerated, whether you still have to disclose it. And it does affect people. With the online presence, it's hard to just simply erase
And you can't say, well, these 20 years where I didn't have a job, I was just looking?
That's incredibly hard to get past, absolutely.
And you, William?
Yes, these are 23 and a half years, is a long time to try to, to make up an excuse of where were you. I mean, it's impossible, literally, 23 and a half years. So I'm coming out innocent, actually. I mean, thank God it came out. I was able to come out innocent, though it still kind of leaves a sense of feeling in people's minds that maybe perhaps you were guilty, or maybe
where there's smoke, there's fire.
Exactly. So it's a tough position, a situation to be in.
Well, I'm so pleased all of you are out and have finally been released from prison for crimes you didn't commit, and were able to come on our show. It's been a real pleasure speaking with Jeffrey Deskovic, who is the founder of the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice, and two other exonerated prisoners, Keon Katibi and William Lopez. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you so much for having us, Leonard.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thanks.